Oh.
It's with great pleasure that I welcome Seth Lewis from the University of Oregon here at Oslo Metropolitan University. We're happy to have you here as an Oslo Met Digital Journalism Research Fellow for the week. And we're very pleased to have Seth talk about one of the many topics he is a world-leading expert in. But this topic in particular, because Seth has had a research agenda into the interplay between journalism and technology for several years. And in this study, he will kind of synthesize much of that research and give us some thought-provoking ideas of how to reflect and understand this. Among other things that the researcher Seth Lewis is doing at the moment is a special issue on automated journalism for digital journalists and all kinds of projects. But today, you will present to us under the title Making Sense of Who and What Do Journalism, and the presentation fills exactly 100 slides. So we will have an intense session here with Seth, but welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Oscar, for that gracious and lovely introduction. I hope I can live up to the expectations that Oscar has set up here today. It's wonderful to be here. I appreciate the opportunity to be a digital journalism research fellow here at Oslo Met. I think Oscar has nicely introduced kind of the broad sweep of what I'll be talking about today with regard to making sense of who and what do journalism, particularly in regard to evaluating news and technology in this moment, this period of transition. But first, I want to tell you just a tiny bit about myself and where I'm coming from. I'm coming from Eugene, Oregon. So just for geographical context here, Oregon is north of California and the Pacific Northwest. Eugene is a second largest city in Oregon. It's a city of 150,000 people, so relatively small. It's a nice college town. And there we have the campus of the University of Oregon, which is the flagship campus in the state. And we are known for athletics, primarily, I'll tell you, at least based on our reputation out in the wider world. Eugene is known as Tracktown USA. It's actually hosting the 2021 World Track and Field Championships. It's rather a kind of famous track and field stadium, Hayward Field. In fact, actually has been around for about 100 years, but was recently demolished because they're building a new stadium. But it's famous for folks like Steve Prefontaine, a decorated runner in the 1970s, who died at a young age, and so there's kind of a myth and legend that is built up around Pre. It was also during that time the place where Nike was created. So Nike's founding is attached to Eugene, Oregon, so it's very close to that connection. I was close to athletics at the U of O, including American football. We were well known for our football team and for our mascot, the duck. Let's see if I can, yeah, there we go. A little gif going there for you. So back here now to the show, the real reason we're here. That just gives you a little bit of context about who I am and where I'm coming from. So what I've learned to say after many years of being asked that kind of question, people ask you, what do you do? What is it that is the essence of your work? And I generally say something like the digital transformation of news and journalism. They're looking for something short and sweet. And this always tends to get a reaction because everyone has an opinion. Everyone has an opinion about journalism. About media. And I'm sure you've experienced this as well. It's often not a very positive opinion, but nevertheless, they have an opinion. But they also recognize, too, that in this particular time, there is a lot of work to do in this area. That's usually what they say. Wow, you must have a lot of work to do. Because they recognize that this is a moment of transition and transformation for journalism. It's a time when we're trying to figure things out, when technology has become not just front and center in many aspects of the world, but especially, we could argue, in the case of journalism. So when I talk about what I do, I tend to kind of frame it around two areas of concentration. One of those being what we might call journalism beyond humans. So this includes things such as big data. And so what does data, big or otherwise, mean for various aspects of news? And one thing that Oscar Vestland and I have written about is the idea of we could use these four E's. We like our alliterations, by the way. We'll talk about four E's and also talk about four A's later on. Four E's, epistemology, expertise, economics, and ethics as being four key lenses through which to understand what data, big data in particular, but data more generally means for journalism. We also might think of this as a sociology of algorithms and automation, applying the tools of sociology and perspectives of media sociology in particular to understanding the roles of algorithms and automation in news. One area that I'm working on right now that I find quite fascinating is human-machine communication. It is both an emerging area of study within communication as a kind of subfield, if you will, as well as a concept that has increasing currency and relevance, I believe, for addressing how we think about fundamental questions of what is communication. So, for example, if we have long assumed and assumed in our communication models going back decades now that communication is a thing from one human to another through the mediation, perhaps, of technology, what happens now if we begin to think about communication as embodying also machines, robots, etc., communicating to other humans without necessarily some medium, you know, mediation between them, but almost kind of an interpersonal context, as well as a mass communication context in the form of automated journalism. So this is one of the areas that I'm interested in. So in that vein, automated journalism here is something that I'll talk about a little bit later in this talk. It's the automatic processing of data and rendering that into news narratives, into news stories. And in one sense, this is still a rather niche part of journalism. It's not exactly fully diffused at this point. On the other hand, within the past decade, it has emerged and taken on a very important role as a kind of signal as to what the future of journalism may look like to the extent that algorithms and automation are employed in the actual writing of news stories, things that we have assumed to be very central and distinct to what is human about journalism. And then in that vein, with automated journalism, could a bot actually commit libel? Could it defame an individual to the point where that person could sue for damages and therefore hold a news organization liable? We'll talk about that a little bit later as well. And ultimately here, AI often is thrown around and I think is not very well defined in many cases. But if we think about artificial intelligence, it clearly has implications for many aspects of work and life, including for journalism, including for thinking about what a future of journalism undertakes to the extent that it involves technologies designed to be learning, to sort of be adaptive and flexible in an AI kind of way. The other main area that I talk about is journalism and publics, because journalism is not totally beyond humans. Clearly, much, indeed most, of journalism is about humans and about journalists interacting with other humans, in particular members of the public, members of the audience. And therefore, this area undertakes questions such as how and why journalists use social media. I recently, in an article that I won't have time to talk about today, but is one that is forthcoming in a special issue of Media and Communication that Oscar is editing, we actually talk about this very question. Why are journalists using social media, given that some of the assumptions we have had about social media and its presumed positive influence may not actually be the case? In other words, a decade into research on social media and journalism, we have growing evidence that there are actually problems associated with social media that journalists perhaps haven't fully reckoned with and wrestled with, and neither, in fact, have researchers who have studied these areas. Another facet of this is reciprocal journalism, is a term that we have used to try to describe what it looks like when journalists seek to build more mutually beneficial relationships with members of the audience, members of the public. And of course, we've had participatory journalism in many forms now for several decades, and of course the internet has facilitated a greater forms of this type of interaction. But we could also say that the research has shown much of this is not reciprocal in the sense that there's not a mutually beneficial arrangement there. And part of that is just practical. You have very few journalists and you have many, many people in the public. But in many ways, this can be a more psychological orientation, a kind of cultural shift in thinking about what is intended to be learned and what is intended to be uncovered in that type of relationship, and can it be more positive? I should note, too, that reciprocity, as we've also been looking at in our research, can be a negative, right? It can be revenge. It could be revenge, not just gift-giving, but it can also be kind of giving back negativity in return for negativity. So it's important to look at this type of relationship and how it's evolving. Also the question of imagined audiences. So to what extent do audience metrics, social media, comments on news stories, and other types of digital manifestations influence the types of imaginations that journalists have about their audience? Imagined audience is both an interesting concept in general, and I believe one that is very interesting in particular for journalism as we think about how journalists conceptualize their audience and act toward them. Also, this question of engagement, a buzz term that is often used, but often not necessarily defined particularly well. So what exactly does it mean? Where does it manifest? How and in what ways and why exactly is it being used? Journalistic branding is a topic also that fits into this area and one that we have studied recently, where we have been looking at how journalists think about branding, personal branding, as a form of work and the extent to which they feel pressure to engage in their own kind of self-marketing, self-branding, and how that then changes and influences the type of work that they do in relation to the audience and how they act online. And ultimately here, I want to emphasize this notion of looking at new concepts and pedagogy, again, for both of these areas of research, both for Journalism Beyond Humans and journalists and publics, because my hope today is to highlight the need for new concepts and the role of journalism research and theory development, both to understand what's happening with news and also to help us make sense of changing dynamics around media and technology more broadly. So we need to continually refine and redefine concepts in order to both research these things better and, with regard to pedagogy, teach about them more effectively. So we can start with this question that is connected to the title of my talk today. Who and what do journalism? It can seem obvious and innocuous enough, right? The tautological answer here is one that you might get in a dictionary or something like it, where journalism is that which is produced by journalists. And, of course, that only takes us so far, and we want to unpack and break this down a bit further. Journalism often is presumed to be a distinctly human endeavor, produced by humans, for humans, and with meaning for social life and the public sphere. And all of those things are relatively taken-for-granted notions about journalism, particularly as it has become a professionalized practice during the past 100 years. So we can break this down and look at how things get a little more complicated when we take these terms one by one. So first, it depends on how we define journalism. So broadly speaking, we can say that journalism refers to the making and circulating of public information that people regard as news. But we also recognize that journalism is a really slippery category. I mean, if it's a container, it's a pretty leaky container. It's a profession, yes, but it's one with fuzzier dimensions than ever before. It is a communicative practice, yes, but one that many people can seemingly become part of, which complicates what counts as news and who counts as a journalist. And then second, even if we settle on a definition for journalism, just figuring out who might be doing it is a vastly more complicated question than we might have bargained for. So yes, of course, journalists do journalism, but they are working along and sometimes with, they're working alongside and sometimes in coordination with a growing array of other types of social actors, other types of people, particularly technology specialists or technologists, whose presence and involvement changes simple notions about the who, changes how we think about that. Not to mention, of course, that all of the non-journalists who participate in acts of journalism, right? We can think about the nearly 2.5 billion people now who have smartphones, who contribute eyewitness photos or otherwise participate in being at the right place at the right time in terms of sharing information that ends up being classified as news in journalism. Then third, even when you get comfortable with the idea that you know who is involved, you have to deal with the what here. And the what, I would say, points to the growing role of machines in news work. I mean, of course, technology has long been intertwined with news publishing, as we'll talk about in just a moment. But we're moving into a particular moment, I would argue, when machines, algorithms, automation, and artificial intelligence increasingly can assume roles of gathering, filtering, and distributing information, roles that we have normally associated with humans. And so we have to move beyond anthropocentric ideas that only humans make and circulate news. And moving forward, I would argue the role of machines in news, like the role of robots and machines in many parts of our world, will likely only increase, heightening the challenges that will come up as we try to untangle these issues. So it's complicated, right? There's no easy answer to the question that I just posed, but that is also the good news, because it makes for a really fascinating object of study. It means that there's a lot to do in trying to understand what's happening today. And I should also add here, too, that if you're thinking, well, news and journalism are not my particular areas of research, I would argue that some of the patterns and principles I'm going to lay out today could be applied more generally to other aspects of media and communication. So I think that when it comes to untangling issues of who and what, they don't just apply to journalism. Okay, so let me start here with a story. This is a story about how I got into this line of research. It was 2011, and I had recently started as a faculty member at the University of Minnesota, my first place where I worked after my PhD. And I was working with Nikki Usher, who's also a researcher who may be familiar to some of you, who's written about interactive journalism and many other aspects of news and technology. At the time, she and I were both interested in understanding what was happening at this intersection of open source computer programming and news organizations and journalism, because there were growing linkages between the two that really were unlike anything that we had seen in recent history. And so we both attended the Mozilla Festival on Media, Freedom, and the Web in 2011. Intending to try to do some ethnography and understand what was happening here. So we looked at how people, and this I should say was a very kind of unconference kind of style. So if you've been to an unconference, you show up, there isn't a set agenda, people propose session ideas, and then people just kind of self-select into different areas and around things they want to talk about. And some sessions are highly technical, some are highly conceptual. In many cases, they're mixing the conceptual and the technical, and the idea is to bring people together from different backgrounds and to try to pursue innovation through the differences and kind of creative, playful ideas that they have. So in this space there, there were people just working together on a whole range of things, doing, you know, various types of activities that were intended to get them to think in creative ways and ways they might not normally do inside an organization. It had kind of a Silicon Valley feel to it. You had various ways in which people could play, work on things like 3D robots. So in studying this space, in this world, and we did that both at the festival and then thereafter in many different settings around the world over the next couple of years, we developed certain ideas about how to make sense of this interaction, this intersection between the two. And one of these appeared in the article Open Source and Journalism in 2013, where we argued that the concept of open source as both a structural framework of computing, of distributed development in programming, could also be seen as a cultural framework of a kind of pro-social hacker ethics. And so we identified then four values of open source culture that are similar to, but also quite different from, the values that are in journalism. So they have relationships, but they're both similar and different, and that creates a point of tension, but also an opportunity for perhaps reevaluation and reinvention within journalism. So, for example, tinkering can relate to coding in the open, using bug tracking, iteration, continuously releasing unfinished code for beta testing. Tinkering, privileging play and experimentation, focusing on the process of work more than its outcome, and participation, or encouraging input from the widest possible group of collaborators. So in some respects, those sound like news, but in other respects, they're quite different, right? News has been more about product and less about process. And so we use this as a lens and entry point through which to examine the interplay of hackers in the, again, the good sense of the word hackers. So people who like to code and program, who are not necessarily in it to try to create mischief and mayhem, but like to try to build technology for good, and how these hackers were working with so-called hacks or journalists. And during that time, from about 2011 to 2015, we saw this huge growth in this organization, Hacks Hackers, which formed meetup groups that met around the world, working on these very challenges and problems. So using the meetup platform, they would organize gatherings. And then when you would go to these gatherings, you might be asked to self-identify as either a hack or a hacker. And it's not necessarily about just building things. This could include just parties that brought people together, like this one in New York. There were presentations like this one in Madrid, hackathons like this here in Toronto, where they're actually building things over the course of several hours or days. And we took some of that additional ethnographic work and interviews to develop this further, and we wrote in this article, Code Collaboration and the Future of Journalism, in this case study, that amid the rise of computational and data-driven forms of journalism, it's important to consider the institutions, interactions, and processes that aim to help the social worlds of journalism and technology come together and collaborate around a common cause of news innovation. So my talk today is going to focus on pulling apart this interplay of journalism and technology, this interplay that is institutional in nature, it's interactional in nature, and opens up a number of interesting processes that can be examined. So although we talked about that in the particular context of hacks and hackers, I would suggest that these patterns can be seen across the wider scope of journalism and technology. And of course, in one sense, there's nothing particularly new about the interplay of journalism and technology. As this Nieman reports, this is an American Trade Press publication, in 2000 put it, technology is changing journalism just as it always has, which is true. On the other hand, of course, I think we can imagine that in 2000 they probably had no conception for the extent to which digital technologies would transform journalism in ways that I think looking back, you know, with that kind of hindsight, would have been far greater, far more substantial than we would have imagined. So it's both easy to say that things have continually changed since Gutenberg, but also harder to recognize exactly how they've changed and why and what kind of meaning that has for the future of news. Again, just sort of an example of how, you know, technology has always been deeply interconnected with news and how it's reported. I think it's worth pointing out that about 100 years ago, there were news stories that would have at the bottom of them a disclaimer that would indicate that the journalist had used the telephone in the course of the reporting on that story, which is not that different than the kind of disclaimers we see at the bottom of automated journalism stories today that suggest that software was used to write the story. So, we're thinking about kind of how we articulate the role that technology has in news, I think, is really interesting. This article recently in Digital Journalism highlights how, you know, automation has been with us for decades. It's not just a recent phenomenon. And he writes, the human-machine development in journalism began long before the introduction of the computer into newsrooms in the 1970s, and no empirical evidence suggests that there will be a break with the past. Rather, we can anticipate a continuous but rapidly accelerating technological development. Journalists are already surrounded by algorithms taking care of everything from web searches to photo and text editing, mostly using them unconsciously and seamlessly. Taking away these pieces of software would reveal to what extent journalists and editors already are dependent on automated systems. Algorithms are the result of human thinking and reasoning, but they are neither entirely material, this is quoting from C.W. Anderson, nor are they entirely human. They are hybrid, composed of both human intentionality and material obduracy. Okay. So I think we could acknowledge that these things are both old, but that there is also something new happening here, and that we need better ways of assessing the journalism-technology dynamic. We need better ways of understanding what is going on and how we can make sense of it. So, for example, journalism has long been idealized as shoe-leather reporting, where reporters hit the pavement in search of the story. This is, as Jay Rosen argues, the one god an American journalist can officially pray to, the idea of shoe-leather, good old-fashioned shoe-leather reporting. By contrast, today, as the anthropologist Dominic Boyer has shown in this book, The Life Informatic, journalism is increasingly screen work. That is, hours and hours in front of screens, managing emails, tweets, user comments, as well as new types of data sets, digital audience analytics, and more. So today's newsmaking, he says, is as much about managing multiple fast-moving flows of information already in circulation as it is about locating and sharing new news. It is, in a sense, an increasingly technologically intertwined engagement. I'll just want to share this quote, too, here. This is from C.W. Anderson in his review of Boyer's book. He says that Boyer's work serves to evacuate the concept of reporting from the world of journalism. Instead, Boyer argues, the dominant mode of journalistic labor is screen work, as I mentioned, a set of almost entirely sedentary processes in which news workers navigate the complex ecology of information already out there, as much as they seek and reveal unknown truths. Okay, so what we're seeing here is a journalism that is increasingly technologically dependent, technologically intertwined. And this raises questions, I would argue, about the technologically specific nature of who and what are involved in journalism and how. Okay, so I want to point out two things in particular. Technologically specific forms of work and technologically specific types of workers. With regard to the first here, we can look at what Matthew Powers has called the technologically specific forms of work. And he articulated this in a 2012 article, and I would argue it's only become more intensified and more obvious since. What we're talking about here are forms of journalism that cannot be disentangled from the technologies that are involved. And this is not a new phenomenon. We can look at photojournalism as the first, one of the earliest examples. You cannot have photojournalism without cameras, without the technology on which it works. So these are forms of work that are utterly interconnected with the platforms on which they're conducted. Now, the result of this, and we see this today, for example, in social media forms of journalism, right, where the type of work being done is totally interconnected with these platforms, that understanding journalism on Twitter and Facebook and Snapchat and other places is partly about understanding the culture and the structure and the affordances of those platforms to begin with, and journalism's dependence on them to do the kind of work that's being done. But also what Matthew Powers points out that's really important, I think, is that these types of work, there's a question of authority. So the relative authority is associated with their technological specificity. In other words, the more technologically specific, the less authoritative, or at least a less authoritative early on. It takes a while for those forms of journalism to be seen as real journalism. It took a while for photojournalism to be recognized as legitimate, normal, regular journalism, to get that kind of legitimacy. In the same manner, today we see that aggregation online and other forms of curation and social media specific journalism struggles to have the same type of legitimacy and authority as shoe leather kind of real journalism. And then second, we can talk about technologically specific types of workers or types of social actors. And here we're referring to the types of people whose work is intimately and interconnected with technology. For example, computer programmers, web developers, data scientists, and others, sometimes called techies, sometimes called hackers, in the positive sense. Some of these are journalists who become coders over time. Others are coders who are brought into news. But either way, increasingly, they have a key part to play in building the editorial news products like news applications and algorithms and so on. So this is kind of a cheeky graphic by the Knight Foundation intended to illustrate what the journalist of the future might look like, some blend of programmer and some blend of reporter into some kind of journalist 2.0. This isn't to say that that's actually what it should be, but rather that I think this is kind of illustrating how people are trying to make sense of the emergence of technologically specific types of actors in news. So bringing all this together amid the disruption in journalism, the multiple forms and activities and social actors, altogether, we can say the study of journalism offers a rich opportunity to examine several key tensions, tensions that I would argue have relevance across media and communication. The first is professional versus non-professional, or the struggle around the sociological process of professionalization, of how an occupation comes to be seen as a profession and legitimated as such. The relative status of occupational insiders versus outsiders, and so on. And the second, producer versus user, or the interplay that is so central to discussions of a network media environment, or around what Axel Bruins calls producage, right? The combining of production and usage functions through digital technologies. Thirdly, this interplay of editorial business and technology, or really, which is, I would argue, a rather neglected three-part interplay, says that we need to consider, often, studies of journalism focus just on journalists or on editorial. We need to consider a broader sweep of people and processes involved, other departments, including business and information technology departments. And we'll talk a bit about that a little bit later in the talk. Fourthly, status versus subordination, or the tension around how certain social actors and their activities are deemed of greater importance than others, which we'll discuss is relevant for journalism as well as other domains. And then finally, what counts, really? What counts and what doesn't count? How are judgments made about relative value in the symbolic capital sense, or values in the sense of ethical norms and considerations? How are such evaluations negotiated, and in whose interest do those things occur? So journalism, again, affords an interesting context in which to explore these and other tensions. We can reorganize these tensions around three key concepts that I'd like to talk about today. And I think our plan is to, I'll probably talk about part one here, and then I think we'll take a break and come back and finish parts two and three. So these three areas can be understood as kind of boundaries, agents, and worlds. The first is a question about what qualifies as journalism? Who qualifies as a journalist, and who gets to decide and why? Right? So these are questions of boundaries, of how we determine and demarcate inside and outside, in and out, etc. Second, what are we to make of the increasingly visible interrelationships of humans and machines, both generally and in journalism particularly? And so this points us to the second part here about agents, but it's also about the relationship among editorial, business, and information technology. And then finally, how might technology be associated not only with different forms of work, but also with changing forms of valuation about the relative status of the type of work that's done and who does it? And that gets us into talking about social worlds and its way of highlighting these different aspects of valuation. All right, so first, let me just briefly outline each of these concepts just a bit further, and then I'll take them up one by one. So boundaries can be defined here as symbolic contests in which different actors fight for definitional control, for determining how things get defined. They work to apply or remove certain labels or to otherwise establish jurisdiction over a social domain. And Thomas Guerin famously described this as boundary work in 1983. And he was talking about science. His purpose was to say, how is it that scientists determine what counts as science and what is considered non-science? And his point was to say that, you know, that definitional work is not insignificant. In fact, it's very significant because it tells us a lot about science and scientists by how they use different things like peer review publication, conferences, titles, and labs, and other means of demarcating this is our space and that's your space, and let's keep these two separate from one another. Second is agents, which I'm using as just kind of a broad catch-all term for the people and things that constitute cross-media work activities. That is, the stuff of media institutions working across multiple platforms and in relation to various technologies and various audiences. And this is something that Oskar Veslund and I have written about and talked about as a socio-technical perspective. And again, we like our alliterations, so hence this is the four A's, looking at social actors, technological actants, and then diverse representations of audiences. And it's the activities that link them all together and bring them all together in looking at how these things happen within institutions. And then finally, worlds here can be defined as cooperative networks of social actors emerging around distinct forms of technologically oriented work. That's how I'm looking at the term. This concept, as I'll talk about a bit later, comes from Howard Becker and his sociology of art. And he looks at how does art become art? How does it become recognized as such? And one of the things that he does is to show that we tend to think primarily of the artist, kind of the lone artist toiling alone and rendering a painting as art. But he argues we are missing the wider ensemble, the wider cooperative network of people who are involved in bringing about that thing that gets to be counted as art. And so I'm going to use that term and that concept to try to also illustrate how we tend to do that in the case of journalism and how a social worlds perspective can open up new understandings about the types of people involved in making news. So again, we'll take up boundaries first, part one, and then we'll take a break. The concept of boundaries, I think, is relatively obvious and intuitive, I think, for many of us. But as you scratch below the surface, this is a really generative and interesting concept that opens up a lot of fascinating sociological questions. So to understand any phenomenon, I would argue, begins by understanding what it is relative to what it is not, and how we arrived at those definitions, those demarcations and boundaries. And this relational interplay of insiders versus outsiders, of acceptable practices versus unacceptable ones, gets to the very essence of many social inquiries. We can look, for example, this case from 2014. You might recall, this is when there was the crisis in Ukraine, the struggle for control over Crimea. And during that time, Google quietly made a change to its mapping software. So the hotly contested Crimean region here now appear differently to different types of users. So if you were in Russia looking at Google Maps, you would see a sharp line like you see there, indicating that Crimea was now part of Russia. If you were in the U.S., you would see a dotted line, indicating that it was disputed territory, which is in line with what the American government was saying at the time. If you were in Ukraine, you would actually see no line at all, because according to Ukraine, Crimea was still part of its country. And Google was just trying to say, look, we are trying to be objective. That's our approach. Our approach is to update our map according to the servers in which, according to the servers and geo, we try to stay out of geopolitics by just saying, depending on where you are located and the servers you are using, we will give you a map that renders what that particular area believes the world to be. And so in a sense, this is, maybe not a huge issue. And by the way, it's not exclusive to Crimea. Google has at least a dozen other cases where it has these kind of map differentiations based on where you're searching. In fact, there's one place in the Pacific where it is variously claimed by six countries. So they have six different varieties of maps to render that the set of islands. But I would argue that these distinctions, while subtle, they do matter, because I think they point historically to the importance of mapping. As one observer said, historically, the most powerful map maker in the world was often the most powerful country in the world. So boundaries and the power to define them, certainly as the British Empire and other sprawling powers have no doubt realized, they matter greatly indeed. And also, just to point out, this is not something that is done out there, that boundary making is something also done in here, within the academy, within our own field. And I have been involved in this. This is earlier this year with some colleagues. We published an article about journalism studies. And we were very upfront in saying that this is an effort at boundary work. We are trying to demarcate what the boundaries of our emerging field within the discipline of communication looks like based on our reading. And of course, we welcome all comers in terms of arguing with and trying to kind of build out an alternative model. But our point was to say that if we want to take journalism studies more seriously, that actually means that we need to carve out and establish the boundaries in a more purposeful way. So just to kind of say that this is not something nefarious that other people do. We all participate in some form of boundary making. And what I'm going to talk about here draws mainly from the book that I edited with Matt Carlson in 2015 called Boundaries of Journalism, where we apply these perspectives to the particular struggles of defining what counts as news and who counts as a journalist and so on. Okay, so given the lack of cohesiveness in how scholars have talked about boundaries, which is something we discovered in the course of editing that book, we found that actually there's a great variety of ways that people talk about boundaries. We tried to integrate several key strands of thinking and to principally from sociology, but also from science studies, science and technology studies, the sociology of knowledge, and elsewhere. Thomas Guerin is often the starting point for this type of work. Again, from 1983, he developed notions of boundary work, these social boundaries, as ways that scientists would patrol the parameters of their domain. He argues it's a kind of perpetual social struggle for epistemic authority, for the ability to define epistemology or knowledge over a certain domain. He calls it, quote, the legitimate power to define, describe, and explain bounded domains of reality. So who gets to argue, who gets to say where the boundaries of some particular aspect of reality begin and where they end? Andrew Abbott, thereafter, he did a study of professionalization, or how occupations from kind of the smallest to the largest, from the most formal to the least formal, how many of them seek to become professions. What are the trappings of professionalism? How do they seek to kind of improve their status? And he introduced this helpful notion of jurisdiction, which refers to the process through which a profession asks society to recognize its cognitive structure through exclusive rights. So a little complex, but I think what he's saying here essentially is, how does a profession get people to acknowledge that it is a profession and that it has ownership over certain aspects of society? So how does the law, for instance, come to dominate the law? How does medicine come to dominate medicine? And in turn, to what extent does journalism get to claim social authority over public information it's making in its circulation? Well, what Abbott does really well in this is he doesn't just isolate individual professions. He doesn't just say medicine's over here, law's over here, journalism, and they're sort of all do their own thing, right? They're all involved in kind of in a very internal way trying to build themselves up. No, instead he places them in a shared social space. He shows how they're constantly competing with one another. And in the case of journalism, this means that it's constantly in competition with public relations, with advertising, right? Other information domains that are constantly in some sort of epistemic struggle for who gets to have claim and ownership or a larger share of recognition over certain activities on society's behalf. Another view connecting boundaries, authority, and professionalism is the work of Paul Starr, his work on the history of medicine. He shows how a profession gains power as it comes to be relied on by those outside of it. And again, what's key here is the contextualizing of professions within a very complex cultural landscape. So this works to direct our attention to boundaries. And in particular, Starr talks about cultural authority, or the probability that particular definitions of reality and judgments will prevail as valid and true. So to what extent and in what ways do certain definitions of reality come to be accepted as such? And so you can think about medicine, of course, that's happened broadly, right, across societies generally in terms of how we think about medicine, but it's not just there because it naturally was that way. He's arguing that medicine very effectively established cultural authority over that domain. Okay. And finally here, field theory is another one that factors into this, right? We can use there's another spatial metaphor that's helpful, where Pierre Bourdieu's approach is to say that society is structured into distinct but overlapping fields. And here he's trying to say that he wants to look beyond the more limited framing of profession or the more limited framing of institution, and instead say that we have these various fields, the economic field, the political field, the creative or artistic field, and the journalistic field. And these fields have complex internal structures with their own kinds of contests to establish legitimacy. But what is interesting here is how fields create social boundaries. That is, in this regard, exclusivity is at the heart of field theory. As he says, to exist in a field is to differentiate oneself or to hold the dominant definition. All right, so putting these perspectives together, we can note two things in particular. First, all of these share an emphasis on the role of knowledge, the role of knowledge in demarcating social space. So claims to expertise are at once solidifying while also differentiating. The authorized knowers are held up against those who do not know or whose knowledge claims are not recognized as sufficiently legitimate. And then the boundary between those, between the authorized knowers and the not authorized knowers, becomes a site of tension. A site of tension. In this way, epistemic or cultural authority, fields, jurisdictions, all of these emphasize the need to consider the interaction between insiders and outsiders. So the second thing worth pointing out here is all of these authors in their different ways also call attention to the relationship between structural and rhetorical resources, between talk and action. Right, because in many ways what we've talked about here, definitions, cognitive structure, all this, it sounds both conceptual and very kind of rhetorical, that based on how you talk, you can establish a certain domain, and that may be the case in certain instances. But all of them also talk about how structure factors into this too, that you can, for example, through licensing, through other types of structural mechanisms, material mechanisms, you can create boundaries that can end up serving to insulate professions or institutions. Okay. So how should we apply these perspectives on boundary work to the study of journalism? And I would argue we can draw on Guerin's three broad genres of boundary work that take place around science. He calls expulsion, expansion, and protection of autonomy. Expulsion here is how do you get rid of bad actors? How do you expel that's expulsion. Expansion first, in which rivals strive to be branded authoritative in the same terrain. So how do you claim more territory? How do you expand your domain to include new things that perhaps previously hadn't been seen as part of your area? And then expulsion, of course, is to get rid of bad actors or to push out ideas that you deem threatening. And then protection of autonomy. Here, for example, in Guerin's work, he looks at how scientists erect what he calls interpretive walls to prevent non-scientists, such as governments, from co-opting scientists' epistemic authority. So we can apply these to journalism. And in the book, we do this in relation to participants, practices, and professionalism. And so we can then look at that in relation to these three areas of expansion, expulsion, and protection of autonomy. And we won't go through all of this in detail, but the idea is to say, here's how we can begin to map how the boundaries of journalism work, how certain people and ideas are either included through expansion, are excluded through expulsion, or how they become involved in issues of protecting a field's or a profession or occupation's autonomy from others. So a couple of examples here would be, for example, with expansion under participants and practices, we see things like citizen journalists or tweeting as a journalistic form or television and blogging gaining entry into professional journalism, right? Not initially being accepted, but ultimately being brought in. So the domain's being expanded. Expulsion, a good example of this would be the expelling of a deviant actor. So a journalist who has plagiarized or has falsified information would be expelled, kicked out, lose their job, but also lose their standing as a journalist. Expelling deviant practices, such as dismissing paparazzi photographers as somehow being less legitimate because of their types of practices. Protection of autonomy can be things like their relationships relative to public relations agents, advertising, and so on, trying to keep them at bay, keep them away. All right, so you can see how this plays out across each of these three different areas. Now, one thing I think that is worth pointing out is that boundary work has a kind of inherent antagonism, that it seems as though things are constantly in competition in an almost negative sense, and that somehow boundaries are seen as a space for contest, but not a space for coordination. And that's where science and technology studies offers an alternative perspective. Because STS would say that boundaries can be seen as a means of communication and coordination, not just a place for contest. So an example of this would be the notion of boundary objects from Starr and Griesemer, 1989. They say that objects that can have different meanings for different groups, but they can have sufficient coherence across the different groups or across the intersecting worlds in order to allow exchange of ideas, in order to allow coordination and action to occur. So, for example, they take the map of California. And when a museum was established related to some artifacts from California, in that there was going to be a map. And there was a question about what should be in the map. Should it be ecological zones? Should it show hunting zones? Should it show, should it be more about topology? All the different actors involved had different ideas about what they wanted to see in that map. But they all had a basic sense for the map as a whole, and they had enough commonality and coordination to be able to accomplish something, even though they had radically different ideas about what should actually be involved in that map. So it's one way of thinking about an object that has, and this is something that Nikki Usher and I have used in another study, where we looked at news and innovation, and how, in one sense, hackers and journalists were brought together. And they had very, very different ideas about what journalism should look like, but they had enough coherence around this object of news. News as an object had enough meaning to both of them, similarly, that they were able to do some coordination that resulted in innovative ideas, ideas that you couldn't tell whether they actually came from the journalist or came from the hacker because they were similar enough, showed a kind of level of coordination that was unique to the situation because of news as a boundary object. Another concept here is actor network theory from Bruno Latour. It shifts the focus from these discursive battles that we talked about a moment ago and instead moves the focus over to socio-material connections in a network. How do people and things interact? So it's less concerned with how people are fighting over what counts as science and instead saying, what, you know, who's interconnected in the network, how are they interacting with one another, and with what are they interacting, you know, in machines or other material things, and how does that indicate new types of communication or coordination or connection? So if boundaries then may be about limits, networks in this sense may be seen as forms of connection. All of this is to say that it kind of sets the stage for what we're going to be talking about in the second half of the talk here, to consider how people, different types of processes, some seen as being legitimate, others as non-legitimate, come together, and then with interesting interactions and implications based on the nature of those boundaries.
Okay, great.
Okay, welcome back. We're ready for round two. Thank you for being here again. Appreciate your involvement. And after I finish presenting sections two and three, we should have ample time for questions and discussion. I'd love to hear from you and talk about this together. So we've also gotten past maybe the most conceptual part of this in terms of untangling boundaries, boundary work, and all those issues in depth. We're going to look now at agents and worlds as two related concepts that will continue this conversation. So with agents, it's, again, kind of a catch-all term for referring to the four A's of actors, actants, audiences, and activities. And this relates to the piece that I mentioned before that I wrote with Oscar Vestland in 2015. It published in Digital Journalism. This article arose out of a question that the two of us were wrestling with, which is, can we develop a heuristic to better represent the changing nature of people, things, and processes that make up digital media work? And we were interested in looking at not just editorial processes in newsrooms, right, very much focused on journalists, but also looking at the wider range of people, such as business people and technologists who are involved in the making of media, so kind of more from a cross-media perspective, as well as the various things, algorithms, platforms, and other material things that were increasingly evident in forms of media work we're seeing in digital journalism today. So that was the genesis for this study, and in that, we presented a conceptual mapping of these four A's, again, defined as social actors or humans in news production, especially journalists, of course, but also technologists and business people, people who are internally situated within the news organization. Secondly, technological actants, non-human machines enrolled in news production, so apps, algorithms, automation, content management systems, APIs, et cetera, et cetera. Different types and configurations of audiences, varying by distribution platform, as well as by articulation by producers. That is, how are the people making media thinking about the people for whom they are making it? Are these audiences presumed to be active or passive? Are they presumed to be recipients of news who might act upon it in a democratic sense? Or are they presumed to be commodities to be sold to advertisers, right? There's different perceptions that might be assumed here with regard to these types of people. And then finally, work practice activities. This is the final A, and it's the thing that wraps all of this together. All the activities to which actors, actants, and audiences come together and are interrelated with one another. And then one way of visualizing this would be in a diagram such as this. And here we're saying is, again, actors, actants, audiences, and then activities being kind of the part in the middle that connects them all together. And these activities of note can be as, you know, simple as daily routines of production, all the way up to forms of strategic media innovation. In fact, another related article that Oscar and I wrote looked at forms of media innovation and how you could think about innovation from the perspective of each of these A's, these three A's. Could innovation be actor-led? Could it be audience-led? Could it be actant-led, right? What configurations of these three A's, how could they be involved in strategic innovation for a firm? What we did in the article then was to take these four A's and then apply them to the context of news production. And if we say that, all right, news production has roughly five steps or five key processes is connected with it: access and observation, selection or filtering, processing or editing, distribution, and ultimate interpretation, then how might these A's be involved in each of those processes? Or more particularly, might they influence the activities that occur in each of these stages? So just as kind of a heuristic, kind of a yes-no perspective on what we might assume to occur or what could occur, depending on different configurations, when it comes to thinking about what role tech journalists, technologists, and business people especially might play. Now, we can do the same thing in looking at actants, but now actants may be situated internally to the news organization, perhaps ones developed by the organization, or external. These are not, you know, platforms, social media platforms. These are algorithms developed by third-party companies, et cetera. So again, looking at the five areas of news production and then these types of actants, what type of influence or role could they play? And then finally, might these different types of audiences influence different activities of the news production process? And here we're saying that when it comes to journalists, technologists, and business people, there are three primary perceptions of audience that emerge based on the literature. One is of audience as recipients, another is of them as active participants, and the third is commodities. And we might say that journalists, for example, would tend to see them as recipients, people waiting to receive, interested in receiving the news they produce. Technologists tend to see audiences as more participatory, right? They at least have, they're more interested in creating applications and means of allowing people to be more active and engaged on a website and so forth. And then business people might generally see them as commodities to be sold to advertisers because that is the essence of what they are trying to do when it comes to supporting the business of the organization. So just to take that last area as an example, we might, for example, say, okay, from a yes-no perspective, might we presume that this type of audience kind of evaluation might be associated with these types of news production processes versus others, okay? So again, our purpose in drawing these out in the article was to simply say, here is a starting point based on what we know from the literature that can help to guide future research for evaluating how cross-media work happens, how different types of people, things, and activities may be involved, and also how different conceptions of the audience could play a part in what we assume as well as what we evaluate to be happening when it comes to these types of news production areas. So just as an example here, an active participant approach to audiences would lead one to believe that they would or should have a role to play in access observation, in selection filtering, but not necessarily in processing and editing, which the literature has shown is, you know, deemed to be exclusive to journalists and exclusive to the news organization. But we would expect them to share the news online and to be part of distribution. We would expect them to have an active role, of course, in interpreting it. Whereas, as just a quick contrast, the commodities perspective might not really expect audiences to play any part in either observing, filtering, or editing. But we would be happy if audience would please share the story, right? And please circulate it to their friends and be part of that distribution process, but would not really be keen on seeing or having any apparent interest necessarily in audience interpretation from a kind of public sphere democratic standpoint. It's relatively ancillary to the particular question of audience as commodity. So our purpose in sketching this out was to use this as a starting point for understanding how we can rethink news production in light of a broader ensemble of people and types of actants involved in these different activities. One way we can apply this is to think about the case of automated journalism, which is sometimes called robot journalism or algorithmic journalism. I think automated journalism is a more appropriate term because, as we'll talk about in a moment, the robot characterization is problematic. These are not robots writing news. This is software producing news. But yet, if you look at stories, especially in the trade press or the popular press, about this phenomenon, you'll find many characterizations like the one above. I mean, sort of cheeky, right? Intended to be kind of funny about robots or other types of small machines actually typing out news. But nevertheless, what we're really talking about here is algorithmic processes. So software algorithms that convert data into narrative news with limited to no human intervention beyond the initial programming. So fairly templated news, but nevertheless news that is not produced by humans but produced by machines. Again, if you go online and look at these stories and articles about this phenomenon, you'll get some really interesting representations. And for whatever reason, these robots look like something that are both a mix of the future and a mix of the far past. Here the journalist has a smoking habit in addition to being a robot writing on a typewriter. And here the robot is now working on a computer and has kicked the smoking habit, but still wears the fedora with the press logo. You'll get representations such as this, or this one that appeared in the New York Times. So it's I think it's indicative of how people are trying to make sense of this phenomenon. And so when we need a visual often to help us understand something, and so this is the visual that people have generally chosen to illustrate automated journalism, but it doesn't actually reflect what is happening. But I think that just speaks to the difficulty of untangling what this actually means for journalism when it is not entirely visible and therefore sometimes a bit hard to connect with. There have been various reports such as this one from the AP talking about what newsrooms may look like in an age of smart machines as machines or software not only write news, but increasingly act as a kind of complementary agent to journalists and actually provide suggestions and story ideas and kind of surface information through various data and sensors and networks. So what do we know so far about research on automated journalism? What we know is that it's taken, like a lot of the research that on news production, it's taken a processes and products perspective. So that is, when a new phenomenon emerges in news, generally research looks at describing what's going on and describing the outputs that come from that new thing. So you don't see as much conceptual or theoretical work from the beginning, but at least here's what we know so far. Much of the research has talked about content. So what is being produced? What types of news? Often it's sports, it's financial earnings reports, the types of content that can be easily replicated based on very highly structured data. And that's the essence. That's a very key part of this. Unless you have the structured data and unless you have the templates designed to match that structured data, it's very hard to produce this type of news. But beyond just what they're producing, how is it being received by audiences? Like, how do they perceive this? And that you find that a lot of the research is focused on these types of questions. They'll use experiments, generally, or surveys to look at how credible, how realistic, how interesting, and so on, people perceive this type of content to be. The second is practices. So where does automated journalism fit into news routines? Where does this figure into what newsrooms are doing? And so an example of this would be studies of how journalists themselves perceive the software. Do they think that the software works well? Do they think it actually does a good job in producing stories? What are its strengths and limitations and so on? And then to a lesser extent, we've seen research emerge recently on implications or accountability. So this includes things like, what are the legal and ethical considerations or concerns that arise with automated news? But I would argue that relatively little has addressed a key question here, this interplay of human and machine, or of journalists versus other social actors inside and outside the organization when it comes to representing what is automated journalism. So this, I believe, points to a good base of descriptive research, but a more theoretically informed future that we need to explore together. So a 4A's perspective, while not the only way to look at this, is one helpful approach. And it might lead us to ask questions such as, how do different social actors, for example, these journalists relative to technologists and business people, how do these people shape the norms, values, and ethics that are encoded from the beginning into technological actants such as the story algorithms? So how might these different social actors have different perspectives on what that should look like? Go back to that again. Next one here is, how are actants differently programmed internally? That is, with depending on whether they're programmed within the newsroom or depending on whether they're programmed externally outside the newsroom by a third-party provider, how might that lead to different forms of news production, different representations of it, different assumptions, and so on? And then thirdly, how are audiences conceptualized in the algorithms? I mean, perhaps there's a bit of an irony, I think, here in the sense that at the very moment that we're talking a lot about how journalists need to have greater interface with audiences, need to find greater forms of engagement, even perhaps reciprocity, building a more mutually beneficial relationship, etc., at that very moment, we are also introducing technology that is designed to produce news in the seemingly most faceless way possible. And actually replicating a story form, the inverted pyramid type of story, and in some ways freezing that into place and assuming that that is what audiences actually want. And I think there's probably a lot of research to be done with regard to how audiences not only see the credibility of this type of news, but whether this actually represents what they want from the news, or whether this is actually a productive path to take, and how do the producers see the audiences through the algorithms? What kind of image of the audience do they have in mind when they build these types of systems? And then finally, to what extent can these actants learn on their own? Much of the automated journalism today is produced in a kind of template way. Some people describe it as Mad Libs. If you've ever played Mad Libs, you're sort of plugging in words into spaces and you get kind of often like a very funny result. Well, this is not intended to provide some funny result, but it is intended to provide a fairly structured account based on plugging in data into a story template. The future quite likely will involve algorithms and actants that are intended to modify and adapt and learn, in a sense, kind of through machine learning. And that will have really interesting implications for things like liability, if a bot were to commit libel. That was the focus of some research that we've done recently. I worked with some media law scholars on evaluating what might be the potential of libel by algorithm. Could automated journalism be implicated in legal liability? And we argue that, yes, this is a very hypothetical, perhaps even fantastical notion that an algorithm producing a story could somehow, commit libel by defaming the reputation of an individual. And so we say that, although the scenario may seem far-fetched, a review of legal cases involving algorithms and libel does suggest that news organizations must seriously consider legal liability as they develop and deploy news writing bots. Because basically what the law, at least within, I shouldn't point out, this is within the American legal framework, and the reason we use the American framework is because the U.S. has the most expansive free speech protections, most expansive protections for journalists in the face of a libel lawsuit. So if you can be sued for libel in the U.S., you are much more likely to be sued. You could more likely be sued for libel in any other place around the world because of the expansive protections in the U.S. And so the problem here for news organizations is that they can't fall back on some of the defenses that other providers might use, like Google. They simply don't have the standing to do that. And so even though it's a very hypothetical, far-fetched scenario, if the algorithm were to produce a story, for example, based on bad data, that were to defame or libel an individual, they could be at great risk. Okay, so hopefully that is giving you some sense for how we can think about this relationship of humans and machines, of different types of humans, of different representations of audiences, and how they're all interconnected in news organizations. So we've looked now kind of internally within the organization. I want to now look externally beyond the organization, but within the broader occupation or social space of journalism. So looking at this idea of worlds as a perspective on how different practices, priorities, and perspectives can move across organizations, but yet within an institution such as journalism. And what I'm going to present here draws from a chapter that we published recently in the book Remaking the News. I highly recommend it. A great book by Pablo Waskowski and Chris Anderson that evaluates the future of journalism scholarship in the digital age. Now, just to kind of start here, we can revisit and clarify a few assumptions that we've looked at so far. Journalism as an occupation and a practice is continually remade. It is constantly being refashioned according to the interactions that give it social meaning and shape its boundaries. This is one of the things I hope you've gathered from what I presented so far. So over the past decade and a half, technology has taken an increasingly central role in the journalistic field. I think that is quite obvious. Beyond the technological tools themselves, we've seen ideas of convergence and digital first and fill in the blank, right? Other kind of buzzwords and buzz themes of the time. These types of things have gained a lot of traction in newsrooms and in the curricula of journalism programs as well. We've seen panels at conferences that discuss the merits of training journalism students to write code, for example. We've seen a lot of job ads that are looking for technologically oriented individuals, you know, technologists, hackers, et cetera, who know how to harvest and analyze large-scale digital data. So this is the context in which we're talking here about how journalism is being remade according to these new interactions and the social meanings and boundaries associated with them. I mentioned Nikki Usher before. She's one of my longtime collaborators and recently published this very good book, Interactive Journalism, that looks at hackers' data and news. So she examines, for example, the rise of news application teams. So this is the GitHub profile for the Chicago Tribune's news apps team. And the point here is to say that, you know, amid these changes we've just discussed, different actors who were once on the outside or on the margins of newsrooms have moved closer to the center. So, for example, the so-called computer nerd once tasked with fixing your email or the printer is now used to shovel content onto the website. That type of person, maybe from a couple of decades ago, is now enrolled in coming up with new storytelling techniques or helping to make news more interactive and is very much involved in very central aspects of news and how it's made, which is what Nikki talks about in her book. So what we're seeing here is changes that contribute to new contexts in which journalism is understood as a social system and how journalism is applied as an occupational practice. So in other words, these shifts enable what I would call new kinds of interactions, which continually redefine the social meanings of news. And this, for that type of perspective, we can draw on the framework of symbolic interactionism. So symbolic interactionism, like other long-standing theoretical perspectives, is a really broad umbrella, and we don't have time really to get into all of its particular details. But what it's encompassing is a wide array of empirical research on things like emotion, the self, identity, social relations, and so on, as well as theoretical emphases such as social constructionism, postmodernism. And it also has a range of schools of interactionism that have developed over the years. For our purposes, just to keep it simple, it's worth focusing on Bloomer's 1986 articulation of three core principles of symbolic interactionism. First, it's that people act toward things, including each other, on the basis of meanings they have for them, right? So that how we act toward others is simply based on our understanding of who they are from a very simple level. And these meanings are transformed continually through interpretation. That is, they're derived through social interaction. So we act toward people based on what we know about them, what we perceive of them, but then those meanings are continually remade as we interact with them. And that those meanings are managed and transformed through an interpretive process, one that is used to make sense of and handle the objects that constitute the social world. So there's this, you know, essentially you have this interplay of meanings, interaction, and interpretation going on. And so social coordination occurs when there is agreement on the meaning of objects. When we can agree on what certain things mean, social coordination happens. But what things mean is not a simple matter, right? That what things mean derives through this three-part process that plays out iteratively again and again. So let's try to apply this in a particular context here. And this is what Howard Becker did, a great sociologist, in his work, 1982 work, Art Worlds, where he introduces the notion of art worlds that seeks to explain art as a sociological process. And it's worth pointing out that Howie Becker himself, here he is at the piano in 1950s Chicago Jazz Club. He was a noted artist himself, creator, quite a wide-ranging thinker. And he was quite curious in understanding how do some types of things become recognized as art and others not? And how is that in both a cooperative process and not just something done by a single individual? And if you've ever, you've seen jazz or you've been part of a jazz group, you know that that's how jazz works, right? It's a number of people involved in bringing about that thing that is called art. So he refers to art worlds as cooperative networks of actors and activities that are oriented around the creation and distribution of appreciated works. Now, he, of course, was focusing on art, paintings, music, and so on. And so I'm hesitant to adopt a particular frame of art when it comes to journalism. I mean, some people might say that journalism is art. Others would contest that notion. But Becker was not really concerned with art per se. He was primarily concerned, I would argue, with understanding how creative processes come to be seen as somehow better than others, or certain creative actors come to be seen as maybe better than others. So we can apply this to the idea of understanding creative work within journalism. To use worlds as a lens, then, means defining it in terms of cooperative networks of actors oriented around the creation and distribution of appreciated works that include journalism. And what's important to note is that multiple worlds may emerge around particular forms of work and ideas. So in this case, there can be, you know, distinct but also overlapping worlds within painting, as well as within other worlds of art. So within, for example, painting, it has, you know, worlds of landscape, portrait painting, still life, etc. So we can see how even within one larger world of art, there can be sub-worlds of art as well. So building on Becker, then, a world's perspective opens up some interesting paths for applying symbolic interactionism as a framework and bringing that now to the context of journalism. Okay, so it helps us, a world's view helps us understand how various meanings might be forged by and among different actors, and how those meanings are acted and reenacted through shared practices, and ultimately how shared interpretations emerge through those practices, which allows further coordination to occur, and in turn leads to the allocation of symbolic capital, like greater status or greater prestige. So ultimately, what I'm interested in here is in how the meanings around what is and what is not technical work or creative work, that is, the artistic work or the supporting work, how these different meanings might be shifting through symbolic interactions across and within distinct worlds of journalism as new technologies and new types of actors enter these spaces. So I think it's worth noting again that this is not about an empirical or normative definition of what counts as creative or what counts as technical, but rather it's about localized, contextualized meanings that become ascribed to such terms, to certain practices and certain people. So these are, in effect, kind of social constructions worth exploring because they contribute to the broader definition of journalism amid technology change. So essentially, what do we consider to be creative? What counts as being of higher status? And what do we consider technical? What do we consider support work within journalism? And how do those definitions vary across time? And how do they vary across different types of groups? All right. So there are some really useful concepts from Becker's framework that I want to focus on in particular. One is collective activity, or we might also call it, connected or coordinated activity. So first, it's important to understand that actors within worlds are interconnected, and the meaning-making emerges from these collective activities that they engage in. So there's an orienting force in accomplishing something together, so that they move from idea to acquiring resources to executing on that idea and distributing the product. Right? That is what an art world does, and we can in turn look at how this plays out in the context of journalism, the collective activity that brings about the creative work. Second, there are conventions. He defines these as the ideas and understandings people hold in common through which they affect cooperative activity. We could liken these to routines or to norms, things that are taken for granted but are seen as the fundamental ways of working that bring about, through these conventions, that bring about the thing that is seen as creative and worth sharing. And finally, Becker talks at length about reputation or the valuation of specific works and individuals. For example, whether a work is creative and its author a creative worker or something less. Now, I would argue that it might be better to use the broader lens of status, which also embraces the valuation of the function that one plays within the network, in addition to the quality of that work. So here we're talking about the valuation conferred upon the work or the worker through a process of consensus building. So how is it that some people and some things they do are seen as better than others? And if you may recall, this kind of harkens back to the idea of technologically specific forms of work and technologically specific forms of workers that we talked about before, who had differing levels of status within the newsroom based on the way that their type of work was technologically connected. Okay. So I've hinted at this, but I just want to make sure we're explicit here that worlds are dynamic. New worlds are emerging. Other worlds are fading away. Worlds are constantly changing over time. And Becker, in his book, actually points to technology as being one of the most important, but not the only drivers of change within worlds. Within journalism, we've seen, you know, these are some examples that I want to highlight today, but there could be others as well that you could point to. These are examples of worlds, and I want to point out again, too, this is not that we have empirically verified that these are the three most important or the three only types of worlds, but simply indicative of the types of social worlds that could emerge when we evaluate how social meanings are developed in journalism. Okay, and these are ambient, data, and algorithmic social worlds of journalism. Let me explain each of these in detail. So ambient journalism here refers to a kind of journalism that is oriented to working with ambient media, with media of that are like social media, for example, media of flows, media of effervescence, media that is sort of coming and going and moving in an ambient fashion. I think Twitter being a good example of this, right? A kind of continuous stream of flow that requires the journalist to have a particular skill set in managing all that ambience and, frankly, all that abundance of information, right? So there's a particular ability to conduct journalism using the types of structures, platforms, affordances, and truly limitations of these types of environments. So Andy Carvin is often held up as a quintessential example of what we are calling ambient journalism, of effectively harnessing the medium, in this case Twitter, to conduct a kind of journalism that is distinct and unique to that platform. He came to prominence, at least in the U.S., came to prominence during the 2011 Arab Spring, because he did some of the most consequential gathering, filtering, reporting of that event, but he was doing it from Washington, D.C. Now, he benefited from having many contacts in Egypt and Tunisia, but ultimately he was rather effective in using Twitter to verify information, to gather details, to kind of act as a sort of one-person newsroom, and using Twitter as his newsroom, really, to manage these ambient flows and to make sense of them in a journalistic fashion. So within the world of ambient journalism now, this is recognized as a kind of particular creative ability. Just to give you one indication of that type of, you know, valorization of this type of work, there is a graduate program at CUNY in New York City in social journalism that's particularly focused on just social media and journalism, which I think gives some indication about the emphasis on becoming not just good at journalism, but good at this particular kind. Data journalism is one that I'm sure you're familiar with and that has grown to prominence over the past decade. Data journalism is associated with both perhaps, you know, being a really effective way of storytelling through data, but also has been associated, I think, with errors of late, right, as infamously during the 2016 election. So these are some examples from the website 538, which is often held up as a very kind of prominent, high-status example of data journalism for the way in which they have effectively used statistics, visualization techniques, and other data approaches to conveying stories and news in a visual, interactive kind of way. And you've seen this now in terms of the rise of data journalism awards and other types of things that indicate that there is a particular world of creative activity and that people who can visualize and illustrate data in these types of ways have a certain creativity associated with them that is valued as such within that world. And then finally, I've talked already a lot about automated journalism, but we can see other ways in which algorithmic journalism more generally, the broader use of algorithms to make news and to distribute it, is seen as kind of an emerging area of work. We could also relate this to computational journalism and the types of people who are well-regarded and are high status for their ability to use algorithms to conduct journalism, whether it's in creating news, writing, you know, news story algorithms, or in using automation in the newsroom in other ways to create sensors and other types of story surfacing techniques through code. So In this table here, what I want to show you is how each of these distinct worlds of journalism can be explained by considering their forms of collective activity, right here, the orientation they take, the type of conventions or routines that they have, and the types of status or symbolic capital that they afford. So we can see how that plays out across each of these. So we can illustrate this first example of ambient journalism. The collective activity or orientation is optimizing news for a social media environment. The routines may be using social media as a key framework for gathering, verifying, and sharing information. I pointed to the example of Andy Carvin and his much lauded use of Twitter during the Arab Spring as an example of kind of an individual claiming symbolic capital and higher status by virtue of how they have worked within that world. Data journalism here, the collective orientation, the collective activity is making data more public or transparent and interactive. The routines focus on applying social science techniques, identifying patterns versus anecdotes alone, but looking for data patterns. And then I pointed to the example of 538 and Nate Silver as a prominent model of data-driven analysis. So we can kind of see how we're using the terms from Becker's approach to reclassify and reanalyzing these different aspects of news that are emerging. And finally, with algorithmic journalism, if its orientation is applying AI and automation to expanding the space of news production, and if its conventions or routines are about employing code to automate traditional journalistic functions, then a high status kind of example would be the Associated Press drawing on automated insights and other data to produce 10 times more stories than they used to produce about quarterly earnings reports produced by major companies. Okay, so as these examples indicate here, new worlds are emerging in journalism, I would argue, that are largely oriented toward actors, practices, and conventions that were once viewed as strictly technical. And in particular, this points to an interesting turn in journalism where the technical has gained currency as a kind of creative among a growing portion of its constituents, right? So that if 10 years ago people with these types of technical skills were viewed primarily as support staff, now they are recognized, at least within their worlds, but even I would argue within the broader world of journalism, as higher status individuals who have creative things to contribute that I think confounds these typical distinctions we make between technical and creative. Now, this is also not something specific to journalism. In the book, Becker talks about how recording engineers and sound mixers, they were once largely viewed as technical support staff who were assessed by their ability to capture sounds of a performance, but that more recently they have gained prominence as new technologies have enabled them to manipulate audio. And eventually they came to be seen as skilled artists who created music and treasured music within their own distinct world of sound mixing. And he wrote that in 1982. I would argue over the last 30 years, DJs probably are in a similar category, right? Taken for granted maybe as tech support staff in a way for quite a long time, and now seen as creative artists for their particular abilities within their distinct worlds of creation. Okay, so what does all this mean? What does it contribute to how we think about journalism and technology? I want to highlight a few contributions that I think this makes. It's a way of highlighting how meanings, interactions, and interpretations, again from the symbolic interactionism perspective, how these are associated with forms of creative work. It gives us a way of examining interactions across organizations, that is, not just specific to one company or one firm, but across multiple organizations, and yet inside a single occupational field. It's a reminder that journalism should be understood as a more diverse set of overlapping but distinct worlds of work. So we also shouldn't look at journalism as being particularly homogenous when we recognize that it can have within it multiple worlds of work that have their own forms of valuation and status. And it raises questions of valuation in creative work. Who counts, what counts, and why? How does it come to be that way? So ultimately, these shifts in meaning, even at the local level of distinct worlds, contribute to the larger negotiation. This is how things all come together here. The larger negotiation of boundaries of journalism, of what constitutes journalism, of who gets to practice it, and what it's for at a most fundamental level. So the examples I've described here, suggests that as technology and technologists come to play a more central role in journalism, they are not only carving out space for localized forms of status for themselves, but they're also beginning to redefine traditional distinctions between creative and technical, particularly within journalism. So if we can play this out here and see how these things happen at different levels of analysis, different forms of emphasis or orientation, and with different types of social or technical dimensions. Let me kind of walk through this briefly. So if we take boundaries, agents, and worlds, we can talk first about levels of analysis. What type of level of consideration is at work here if we're trying to do research or study this phenomenon? If we're talking about boundaries, we're interested primarily in occupations and fields, how journalism works as an occupation or a field. An agent's perspective points to the organization. Who and what are working within a firm to bring about media work? And then a world's perspective kind of blends these to some extent because it says, how are things working across organizations, across institutions, but within occupations, within that space? With regard to what is emphasized here with boundaries, as I pointed out, discourse is often the thing that is most analyzed. We're looking at talk, how people are relating to one another. It's not the only thing that is looked at, but generally is often what is analyzed or studied. With agents, we are interested in activities and tracking the various activities that bring humans, machines, and audiences into connection with one another through the organization. And with worlds, we're focused on meanings. How are meanings made, and how are those perpetuated and result in certain forms of valuation? Finally, are these more social or more technical in orientation? And a boundaries perspective is, you know, based on theories from sociology, is primarily social, but with increasingly, I would argue, kind of material or boundary object orientations and perspectives from science and technology studies. We get a more technical perspective on boundaries. Agents is by nature a socio-technical perspective intended to blend human and machine worlds. And finally, the last perspective worlds here is social primarily. It's looking at how people build symbolic interaction and meaning among themselves. It's not entirely human, but it certainly gives more emphasis to how these social interactions and what they mean. So a few concluding points here to kind of bring this all together finally. Back to this original question of who and what do journalism? Technology, work, and technologists as workers confound traditional boundaries, types of actors, and forms of creative work. These conceptual lenses, boundaries, agents, and worlds, can offer macro, micro, and meso perspectives on key sites and cases. Now, sometimes those terms are used differently to describe different types of boundaries. My purpose is to say that if we think of macro, think of macro as like the occupation level, the professional level of journalism, think of micro as within a single organization, and then meso perhaps as a world's perspective that links both of them together, that considers things that happen across organizations but within an occupation. And then finally, these perspectives can help us better explain the social actor configurations, people, and the meanings of those configurations, as well as the relationship between humans and machines that is increasingly central to how we understand news. Thank you.
Many thanks, Seth. And with this, we have 15 minutes for questions and discussions. And I will sit down again and I...
Sure, go ahead.
I could start with
Oscar, go ahead.
One question, because you've been discussing here social coordination quite a bit. And could you perhaps reflect on social coordination in relation to knowledge coordination? I think knowledge-based theory, mm-hmm. this idea of collaboration, because one thing you haven't mentioned much, but I know you're well aware of, are the internal boundaries between editorial and business, and to some extent previously also the technology department. And how can social coordination help enlighten and bring this together?
Right. Yeah, good question. And I should have probably more clearly articulated that there are longstanding boundaries between these departments within most media organizations. For example, the boundary between business and editorial is there for reasons of preserving what is seen as the sanctity of the news production. That if news and business are too close together, the thinking goes, then the news may be tainted by advertising and commercial interests. The boundaries between technology and editorial, boundaries between technology and business, the reasons for those boundaries have not been as entirely clear over the years, other than perhaps that they were seen more as technical support staff and less as deeply involved in the actual making of news applications and products. I think you've seen over the last couple of decades a weakening of the boundaries among all of those three, right? Where I think journalists, recognizing the need to basically understand their business more, there's now kind of a recognition that they need to coordinate and have some degree of communication across the departments within the organization. And I think that, and scholars are arguing well, that I think it doesn't necessarily mean that that's going to result in sort of infecting the news with commercial interests, but rather could lead to a more productive conversation about what do we want to be and what do we want to do. So knowledge, knowledge can't move unless you have people talking to one another and sharing that knowledge and information. And certainly within an organization, for coordination to occur across departments, there needs to be some type of knowledge sharing, some type of social, interactions. And so I think that to get back to your question, I think, I focus primarily on certain types of social interactions within, let's say, the worlds of data journalism or ambient or algorithmic journalism. But there are other types of social interactions that can occur within a news organization and that can be involved in sharing of information. Now, the outcomes or the implications of that sharing are going to be different depending on the organization, depending on what they're working on. Is it a new mobile application they're trying to develop together, or a new type of, another type of innovation for the company? So I'm not sure if that's quite answering your question, but I think it's getting to what you're talking about.
Thank you.
Excuse me. Sin.
Thanks for a really insightful and interesting presentation. And it provides a very nice and very rich framework for both understanding the programming journalism and the incentive journalism, but also the paper critical research on journalism. I was wondering about, because it seems to me that this framework is relevant not only for the relationship between journalism and technology, which is your emphasis here, and whether you've thought of, whether you have thought of using this on other aspects of journalism, not only journalism and technology, but different kinds of journalism and things that are not related towards technology, because it seems to me that both boundaries and roles and agents are sort of useful framework for all aspects. And I was also wondering about how you define technology, because in your talk you seem to sort of mostly link technology to digital technology.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Then you also use like camera.
Yeah.
We talk about digital platforms as technology, but not printed newspaper as technology.
That's a great point. Yeah. So very good point. Maybe a better term would be, material objects. It'd be a more inclusive term for talking about all the different technologies, including paper, that help to bring about news. There was a special issue of the journal Journalism a few years ago that was about the objects of journalism, and one of the articles was about pica poles from newspaper newsrooms and other sort of artifacts that were important in communicating a certain degree of even power or a certain degree of authority within the newspaper environment. So it had, they were not digital in any way, shape, or form, but these were nevertheless, these were material artifacts that had meaning for influencing the type of work that was conducted. So you're right. A better, perhaps an alternative approach would be to use materiality as a perspective on thinking about technology. I think that technologies writ large are the things that are most salient right now, probably for thinking about the changing nature of news. But I do think it would be a short-sighted to assume that technologies are only digital, because frankly, digital technologies may not be the type of technologies used 50 years from now. Digital is already becoming a certain degree kind of passé, because it points to a kind of technology that is what we're using now, but it may not be the kind of technology of the future. It can be a bit misleading to attach it to any particular era or epoch or type of form. I think to your point about also looking beyond this context of journalism and technology, absolutely. You know, I've been talking about social worlds of journalism. You could imagine how this is true for investigative journalism, for instance, or true for sports journalism. Certainly there are many other worlds of journalism that are not technologically oriented per se, or that are not allocating resources and status and capital based on any kind of technological dimension. My point using worlds here was to show how the boundaries around what we classify as being of higher or lower status, of being creative or technical, can evolve in part on how different subfields emerge and kind of build up certain forms of work that come to be recognized as particularly creative and generative. But we don't need to draw that lens just around technology. And I'm sure there's other aspects of news we could talk about, as well as beyond journalism, looking at other spheres of work. There's certainly other worlds that emerge within the academy, within what we do. There are, constant evaluations based on collective activity, conventions, and forms of reputation or status that are allocated. Does that answer your question? I'd love to hear more about what you think about, because I think that's a fantastic line of kind of broadening this out to consider, beyond technology, how can these concepts be relevant and applied? Thank you. We have time for a few more questions.
I have another question.
All right, excellent.
To open the discussion. Among other things you've touched upon here is the relationship between social actors and audiences.
Yes.
And if you were to assess changes in the contemporary media scape, given the disastrous development of the advertising market, how do you think this is going to change the way journalists, technologists, and business people are approaching their audiences? You were discussing recipients, commodities, and active participants.
Right.
I've heard from you lately that you have some other ideas on how one possibly could approach.
I think that based on the three classifications that you and I used in the paper were based on the literature as we were reading it in 2015, which is that recipients, active participants, commodities are three dominant themes of how audiences have been conceptualized. When you think about what is the basic image in a media worker's mind about the audience, that it tends to be one of those three. But I'm sure that list could be expanded. I'm sure other images and ideas could be developed. One could be thinking about the audience as partner. Right. I mean, of course, even I should mention, too, some people would contest even the term audience, because I work with some colleagues who would prefer community in place of audience, who would prefer some other term, because audience itself as a word has its own connotations and expectations of what you think that person may or may not do with the information you're creating. So, there's obviously a certain degree of kind of needing to problematize, kind of needing to shake up the term audiences for one thing. But also seeing audiences perhaps as partners. So a lot of news organizations are trying to imagine opportunities for membership, for becoming a stakeholder, becoming a having a more partnering like relationship with the media company. So it's less about trying to buy, trying to assemble an audience to be sold to advertisers. Now that we're recognizing that digital advertising probably will never pay the bills. And is simply not probably a viable option in the long run in pursuit of something else to make the economics of news production work. Thinking of audiences differently and more creatively, and thinking of them perhaps as partners and stakeholders, and having a greater stake in the process is probably a more productive way to go. Or at least it's one way that many news organizations are exploring that.
Thank you, sir.
Yeah.
Unless any of the students would like to have a question.
I think it's yours.
But first of all, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I really enjoyed your talk. It was eye-opening in many ways. Perhaps my question is related to the fact that perhaps Norway and Scandinavia is slightly different from the United States. And perhaps the boundary work here historically has been made in a much more organized way, sometimes in negotiations between media businesses and unions of journalists, which is slightly different from and more difficult to capture with methodologies and theories were discussing.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. Yes, go ahead and continue.
So my question would it be possible to use like perspectives like Foucault, or critical discourse studies, or maybe political economy within your framework?
Sure. You mean because would those be more applicable here?
My main concern would be related to power issues and how journalists can have a living salary and have a good life. Would you still be able to use your sort of framework?
Yeah, I think that's a very good question. I think what you're saying is that power is in some ways the unstated problem here. Who gets to have the power to define journalism, and then with that power, who gets to kind of control the terms under which journalism occurs, and how journalists get paid, and so on and so on. But first, I want to take your first part of this, which is that I think you're absolutely right. I certainly am speaking from the context of being an American who understands the American media system better than others, and so it's quite possible that the terms and frames and perspectives I've provided here today are maybe more useful for the U.S. context and perhaps less useful for other countries. I think the point you made about unions is a really good one, because a union, among other institutions, can act as, I mentioned licensing, it can act as a kind of structural barrier, a structural boundary, right? So that a news organization, in determining who counts as a journalist, well, the union tells you who counts as a journalist, because union membership becomes perhaps required in order to work and be paid on a full-time basis, et cetera. So that's actually a really good example of how a structural, non-discursive boundary can be constructed. But at the same time, there is discursive power in talking about unions, in talking about what role they should play, in talking about then, what are the dynamics through which, work dynamics of the political economy in which journalists do their work. And so, I think part of this is reflecting that my own training in media communication studies and like sociological perspectives thereon, and I'm sure that somebody trained more in critical discourse theories, for example, might look at this from a different lens, which I would certainly welcome. And I do think that power is an unstated underlying theme here, and it is one that deserves a lot of attention. In the article I mentioned early on, the one where Matt Carlson, Sue Robinson, Dan Berkowitz, and I are trying to outline the fields of journalism, the dimensions of journalism studies as we're engaging in our own form of boundary work, power was actually one of the kind of final considerations, and one that we argued is kind of an ultimate consideration that needs to be more fully brought to the fore in journalism studies. And my only perspective is I don't know that it necessarily needs to lead to Foucault, necessarily needs to lead to critical discourse theory, but power can be just a more open-ended inquiry into saying who has greater control and influence here and why. And without assuming from the outset what you think you're going to find, but instead kind of allowing yourself to more inductively explore the space and say, how is it that certain people came to have certain authority in terms of defining the boundaries and defining, what counts in this area. But I think it's a wonderful point and question to raise about the issue of power here. Thank you.
Thank you, Seth.
Great.
And with that, we formally close the Focus seminar for today.
Well, thank you. Appreciate being here. It was a real pleasure.
And we'll
thank you.